Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.
Good morning, afternoon, everyone, and evening to everyone, especially to our viewers from the Far East. Good night.
Welcome everyone to our third episode at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's with Ben and myself, Svetlana.
So we decided to start this program as a part of our two visions. Firstly, to raise awareness of the existential threat that our world is facing, especially our children. And secondly, to be the place where people meet.
And to continue on that, so the second part of the vision is, of course, to teach and educate people all around the world on how businesses can use finance as a force for good and become part of the solution. And I mean, you've been educating thousands of people, professionals, entrepreneurs to solve and act on sustainable development goals. So they can call themselves as impact businesses and have the doors open to impact investors. And I now ask to put the slide on because our next free webinar on this topic is on the 9th of February, where we will be teaching exactly this, how to make your business successful and impactful at the same time so you can generate returns, social and environmental impact. It's the next slide, please. One more forward. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's called Profitable Business with Impact. It's free webinar on the 9th of February at 7:30 in the evening. There is a link to join us. So it would be great to have you guys all here.
And I, of course, will be telling the businesses how to structure to business development and, most importantly, how to seek funding for the businesses. This is not only for startup, but this is also for new businesses or existing businesses who intend to grow or come into a new country or a new market. And many of you know that I have been setting up business all around the world, especially around Europe and the US. And I'm well acquainted with the problems that every business faces, whether small, middle, or large. So today, we again stand in front of you on the TV show, and it's about impact investment, where we bring and interview business, political, financial, and thought leaders from all around the world. So today, I wanted to talk about how to reduce our carbon footprint to fight the carbon change. But let's focus on money, because after all, we are talking about impact investment. So how can we save, invest, or donate money which affects the climate? So I'll start with a couple of basic facts which I don't know if you're aware of. For example, the Paris Agreement was signed on 12 December 2015. Fossil fuel investments have, in fact, since then gone up. Between the 35 of the major world banks, it now stands at $2.7 trillion. So we, as common people, as common citizens, I think we can do two activities. First, ask our bank, because the issue is that the banks have the investment side and the retail side, and the retail side of the banks are often ring-fenced. But you can check sites like, there are sites like banktrack.org, and ask your bank to report on their investment policies. Because even though the retailers retail amounts can be small, we can still ask our bank to change their policies or move away to another banks. We can always close our accounts and move away to banks, because nowadays there are more and more banks coming up, which are more ethical and are doing are environmental friendly. And our second power as common people is our pension. So we have at this moment globally around $47 trillion in the pension funds combined together. Half of that is invested, as per the records of 2018, in the financial market. And less than 1% of the 100 of the world's largest pension fund is invested in low carbon investments. So if you would go to your pension fund and ask them to report on your investments, for example, in United Kingdom, in the pension funds are obliged to disclose the climate risk, and more countries are adapting to these regulations.
Thanks, Ben, for this interesting introduction. But let's first relax a little bit. And I'm really excited today to have our next guest, the sixth president of Mauritius. So maybe our audience is already asking, where is she? She's coming. Just be patient. She's coming in a couple of minutes. And I'd like first to share my happiness with everyone. Yes, health is very important and one of the SDGs as well. So finally, I can release my glasses, and today I'm very happy to facilitate without it. So, and to start a little bit of impact investment from my side, I actually wanted to share some of the history about impact investing and provide a little sustainable journey about its creation and related terms like corporate social responsibility and sustainable investing. So actually, the very beginning of what we name responsible or sustainable goes back to biblical times. The Jewish law has established at that time directives concerning ethical investment. And the use of money was considered as the second most important subject of the New Testament teachings in the mid-1700s by the initiator John Wesley. Furthermore, religious investors whose traditions embrace peace and nonviolence, they kept away from investing in enterprises that profited from products designed to enslave or harm human beings. If you are familiar, I'm sure nowadays all businesses have corporate social responsibility. Some of them are really meaning it and implying at their businesses. Some are using it as a marketing tool or like must-have. Anyway, the first mention of corporate social responsibility or CSR can be traced back to the year 1950. And the public concern raised in 1980s much further, because there were such events like apartheid in South Africa, when millions of people, churches, universities, had their center of attention in investment strategies, attempting to influence and force the white minority government to destroy the inhuman political system in this country. After there have been such events like Chernobyl, and even in Switzerland, we had a disastrous event in 1986, when there was a chemical factory at the Sandoz, which caused Rhine pollution and dramatically influenced the environment. So, and let's jump now to sustainability. The sustainability was actually became internationally recognized after the report of the United Nations of 1987, which was called Our Common Future. And sustainability refers to development that meets needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So basically, if we live today, we should live in a way that our children would still be able to live at least the way we do, or even better, right? And finally, coming to impact investing, a term, it was originally defined in 2007, so now 14 years ago, by the Rockefeller Foundation. And they define it as investments made with intention to generate both financial return and social and environmental impact. Global Impact Investing Network, then added a few words to this definition. So now our accepted definition around the world is that impact investments are investments made with the intention to generate positive, measurable social and environmental impact alongside a financial return. And if we translate it to more simple words, so basically you invest in innovative social enterprises which have an underlying mission to solve one or several SDGs and generate positive social environmental impacts, of course, financial return as well, which can be measured. So, I hope it was not a boring history like it's cool sometimes. I tried.
So let's travel today. So where are we traveling today?
Oh, actually, for that, I would need sunglasses back, you know, like we go to Mauritius. Amazing. We have snow in Switzerland, but I would love to go to Mauritius. And it's not only amazingly beautiful country, but it also has quite a unique history. So today I'm a history geek. So a little fact, although it was known by the Malay traders as far back as 10th century, but it remained uninhabited actually till 16th century. And then what it was explored by Portuguese and settled by the Dutch and named after the Prince Maurits of Nassau. It got its independence in 1968. And now it has a stable democracy with regular free election and positive human rights record. And the country has attracted considerable foreign investment and has one of Africa's highest per capita incomes.
And you forgot
anything
to
else?
Add,
yes.
You forgot to add that the United Nations Development Program, the island, and now I'm coming to the more to the part of today, is vulnerable to considerable economic loss, humanitarian stresses and environmental degradation as a result of climate change impacts. Right. The direct climate change impacts likely to adversely affect Mauritius includes an increase in frequency of the intensity of the rainfall and the sea level rise, which as per the last estimation was like around 18 to 60 centimeters by 2100. And of course, increase in the frequency of the tropical zones. So today, we will listen to one of the leaders on the topic of agriculture, climate change, and women empowerment in Africa. She is well-known and a leader in this sector. So with this, we welcome the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius, Her Excellency Professor Dr. Amina Gurib Fakim.
Welcome, Amina.
Thank you. Thank you to the Banerjees for having me on your show.
Good evening. Good evening. You
Good
have
evening.
Already evening, right?
Yes, yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for making the time free for our program, and our global audience is truly appreciating that you could join us today. And in my personal opinion, I mean, you are such an inspiring woman, president, scientist, professor. Wow. How could you do that all in one life? I'm really looking forward that you would share with us how it's possible to do. So, and I'd like to share one slide, actually, if we can see the slide number 4. And on this one, you can see, no, the next, yeah. Today our, yes, exactly. So on this slide, you can see how the world soon will look like, right? So because of your immense experience and experience as a president of a country, especially in the field of agriculture, women empowerment, and all over Africa, I'd like to ask you if we can focus on this topic, agriculture and women empowerment today. And of course, climate change, how it influences Mauritius and what we can do about that.
Thank you. Thank you for, can I start, Ben?
We can yeah, carry of course.
Everyone is watching and waiting you to start.
No, but the map you have shown, in fact, it is very, very worrying. And I'd like to mention up front that Africa, of which, of course, we politically belong to, is not a net emitter of greenhouse gas. But as you will see, as you have seen already, and the projections are there, that the continent is going to be very, very badly impacted. So increasingly, the conversation around Africa is we are looking for climate justice. And this is something that we can talk about later on. But how does this impact agriculture? I think which will be the subject of our talk today. They are manifold. And already we're saying that it is impacting, you have mentioned drought, you have mentioned cyclone, you have mentioned flooding. And I think over the past 5 years, we have seen all these happening in the region. While Australia was witnessing severe fires, the east coast of Africa was underwater. While Australia was experiencing a severe drought, we were experiencing a terrible cyclone in the Southwest Indian Ocean. So this is where I think we're talking about the effect of the El Niño and the El Niño, as we say. And so this is all boils down to to a large extent, to the climate. And as we are a small island state, we are impacted otherwise, because 10 to 12% of the population's protein source come from the sea. And we're seeing a lot of coral bleaching because of the high temperature of the water and also the absorbance of carbon dioxide, which makes the water acidic. So higher temperature means more violent cyclone and coral bleaching. And of course, as you know, that the coral reef, they occupy about, I think, less than 2%, if I state correctly, but over 25% of the biodiversity, the life on this planet will be revolving around the coral reef. So our livelihoods directly depend on the waters, both fresh, of course, and also on the ocean. And the warming is worrying to us. The sea level rise, we're already seeing, of course, the erosion of certain beaches. It's there, it's happening, it's a reality. And this is something that I keep saying, and I've been saying it all along, especially over the past 4 years where it wasn't heard. We need multilateralism back. We need to work as a community of nations towards the common good. And the common good is precisely addressing, one of the common good, of course, is addressing climate change in its entirety. And this is where we call for pledges. We call for, you know, not just pledges, of course, live it to the promise of creating that green fund so that we can enable other nations to adapt, because this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about mitigation, because as I said earlier on, we haven't emitted. So we are talking about adaptation. Exactly. So this is where we are.
But do you have already a green fund set up, or you want to set up a green fund for this purpose, what you just said?
Again, the green fund, I think I'm talking about the global fund. The Global Green Fund, which was pledged in Paris for 100 billion USD. Yep. And again, Ben, and I also mentioned this to you, I'll mention the managers because I don't want to miss either one of you. You know, when we were in Paris, we all said, okay, we brought in our NDCs, eventually become the INDCs. The INDCs become the NDCs. So we all pledged for, you know, the common good, and to create the Green Fund so as to help poorer countries adapt. Now, if you look at the global economy, we are talking about the global economy over trillions of dollars, okay? Mm-hmm. Over trillions of dollars. And here we are looking at a pot of $100 billion. Okay. Yep. And now this is something that I think I would like to highlight, because this links up to your previous emission we had on maps. And I link this up to that. You know, when people talk about these kind of pledges, when people talk about this kind of fund, it's always felt that, you know, they are handouts to poorer countries. Well, it's not. Yep. It's our common survival on this planet. I think the COVID has shown how interconnected we all are. Something happened in Wuhan, and the next day it's in New York, it's all over the place. Now, why am I making the point about the Green Fund and also making the point on the ocean? Because that was your past series you held. Was that, you know, when we talk about ocean, I've already mentioned the sea level rise, the warming of the oceans, but I'm talking about the oxygen that we get from that ocean, And people don't seem to realize that. And the water we take, we take again for granted the water which comes from there. But more importantly, when it comes to diversity of species, be it terrestrial or be it from the ocean, of course, we still haven't assessed fully the diversity that the ocean has. We've seen, for example, the terrestrial biodiversity. Now, if you look at my country, it's a tiny, tiny space, of course, in the ocean. But if you look at the diversity of 1 square kilometer of biodiversity in Mauritius, it would be much more than the entire biodiversity of Europe. And if you look at the level of biodiversity hosted in these small spots across the world, which constitute the global biodiversity hotspots, you find that this is precisely the biodiversity which is providing about 40% of the ecosystemic services to those who are in the vulnerable, which we consider to be in the vulnerable group. So it is tremendous. It is given for free. And yet we are wantonly destroying it. So when we talk about the Green Fund, helping poorer countries, it is not to help. It is to help humanity, because we need that biodiversity. We need that ecosystem preservation. We need to sustain that. You mentioned the word sustainability. And we cannot talk enough about that, because this is exactly what we have to do for the common good, so that our survival is ensured on this planet. And there's also one thing I would like to mention up front, is that when we talk about saving the planet, please, the planet doesn't need us.
I agree.
We are the very tip of the apex of the triangle, a very, very small percentage of species. And look at the damage we've done to this planet, right? So nature doesn't need us. Nature has shown us during COVID that if we get imprisoned, wild animals will take over our cities. That happened, right? So we don't need it. But one thing we have to understand, we are very much part of the ecosystem. We are all interconnected to each other. And the sooner we come to grasp with that, the faster we'll be able to cope with further pandemics. And we're not out of the woods yet, because climate change is here.
I mean, Thank you very much. Amazing.
I completely agree. I just wanted...
We both want to...
You just summarized the whole discussion within 2 minutes.
That's my teaching profession.
Yeah, exactly. I was reading, because now the WEF is going on, and virtually, and there came a very disturbing report. I don't know if you read about it yesterday. It came because I was listening to the web. They came with three conclusions. Climate change will be sudden and cataclysmic. We need to act fast. And they said there are three things going to happen. Tipping point could fundamentally disrupt the planet and produce abrupt changes in the climate. A mass methane release could put us in an irreversible path to full land ice melt, causing sea level rise to up to 30 meters. We must take immediate action to reduce global warming and build resilience with the tipping point. I mean, it's a very long report. If you're interested, I can send it to you.
Please.
It's quite depressing report. Mm. So let's, shall we start with the questions then?
Sure. Yes.
So first, our question was that Republic of Mauritius has transitioned from a low income agriculture-based economy, and you managed very successfully to change yourself to a high-income, diversified economy, relying on quite an advanced financial and ICT sector. How did you manage that? Because you are part of Africa, and your other countries in the part could not do that yet.
Again, I will caveat what I'm going to give as a response, is that there never was a Mauritian miracle. And we are a very small country in the Indian Ocean, just over 2,000 square kilometers in surface area. But we potentially can be an ocean state, because if you take the ocean, we are over 2.2 million square kilometers. But we got our independence in 1968, and sugar was king, because sugar was bringing 92% of the GDP. And in fact, interestingly, I must point this up front, is that there were two Nobel Prize winners who gave the assessment, because we were under the colonial, the British imperial powers, and they said that Mauritius was a lost case because we're too far away from the market, we're an isolated island, subjected to all the rigors, of course, the climate and cyclones and all the rest of it, and we will never survive. And we managed to prove that right, because every 10 years since our independence, we have taken some key strategic decisions to diversify the economy. Now, in 1970s, of course, unemployment was rife because sugar was the only monocrop economy, and the per capita income at the time was about $200. So what happened was that the founding fathers of the island, of course, the very first leaders, what they did, they brought on board three major decisions. The first one was to control birth. Birth control was, of course, immediately put on board. The second one was to give free healthcare. We still have free healthcare today. And the third one was social safety net. And so we spent quite a bit on this social aspect. Of over 40% of our budget goes into this social safety net. But what was much more meaningful, if I may use the word in that way, was free education in 1976. So when free education came in 1976, those people who were cutting sugarcane could now move, because they were getting rudimentary education. They could then go into the fledgling manufacturing sector. So there was textile, which came up, the free zone. Of course, we actually got onto the bandwagon of getting provincial market. And we still had a protected market from the EU because we're past colony for our sugar. But we started diversifying. So we started manufacturing in the early 80s. That helped absorb quite a bit of the unemployment. And it was also a game changer in as much as women got free education. So when parents no longer had to think, because, you know, in our cultures, educating a boy makes economic sense, educating a girl does not. But when the parents, they didn't have to choose whether they were to educate a boy or a girl, then women, of course, got access to free education. So then came the 1990s, we started moving to financial services, and then 2000, we moved into the ICT. And then we had a few interesting decisions which were taken, of course, of making the country a pragmatic, what people call that a haven, but we're not. We had a very pragmatic tax system, which attracted, of course, investment through our country. So this, to me, has been something which was quite fundamental. But there's something, an overriding point, is that we made sure that we had election every 5 years. To be able to change that from the constitution, you need more than 2/3 of the parliament to vote, and it's almost impossible to get. So election is mandatory. Every 5 years, we need to have election. So some people will say it's a short-term vision of 5 years, but others will say at least in the 5 years, they have to work and deliver, get results. Otherwise, they will get thrown out. So this was, of course, ingredients.
Quickly, you know, because there are some countries like Russia where president stays at power now like almost 20 years. Yeah, it has certainly an impact, Emma.
Well, in Africa, we are not any better, because there are some who have been there for over 35 years. So there are some players who are not actually playing ball, but what can you do?
Maybe something, nothing better. That's great. I mean, thanks a lot. Then I proceed with the next question about Gini coefficient, which measures income inequality within a country, because in Mauritius, Gini coefficient went from 45.7 in 1980s to 38.9 in 2006, which is a really fast growing economy, right? So it's a very good improvement. So how was Republic of Mauritius able to reduce income distribution inequalities? And do you see still, it's like a trend, is it still ongoing, or it's just the past?
That's an interesting question, because if you look at the dates that you mentioned, there has been progress, because, as I said, there was employment, full employment, and there was, of course, all these social safety net, free education, free transport, even to kids and older people. So all these help, of course, to actually buffer this. But unfortunately, over the years, and in fact, if you look sectorally, you'll find that the Gini coefficient is going to be very bad, because in some sectors, like for example, manufacturing sector, the disparity between the boss and the workers working on the ground there, it is not the same. So again, these figures have to be reassessed. But we have, as a country, done fairly well, especially we've noticed that during the COVID era, when some country was struggling, people who had no social safety net at all, they were on the street. At least in this country, there is a modicum of social safety net. And this is something that I pledge to many countries to reconsider, because some countries have taken it to a different level. And here I have in mind the Swedish or the Scandinavian countries, the Nordic countries, and where they have taken it to a very, really to an art form. And then you have other extremes, even some very developed countries, they do not have the social safety net. And this is a must, I think, in any country to really relook at that, because no society will be sustainable if those who the difference between the have and the have not is so wide. It is not sustainable.
And I can add to it, remember whenever we had these financial crises, the countries which had social security were the minimum hit, even in Europe. Yes. Countries, yes, which were nearly hit very badly were like UK or Germany, but countries like the Nordics, they didn't get very badly hit. So,
and also there's something else, Ben, if I may ask, if I may add to this discussion, is that you mentioned the financial crisis, right? And I think here, again, something which came out very, very strongly is the rule of law, right? Governance. Mm-hmm. I mean, those who defaulted in some Nordic countries, they were in jail, right? Mm-hmm. So they were taken, yep, to task. Whereas, yeah, in some countries, they become advisors to the presidents, right?
Exactly.
That need to be looked at very, very carefully. We need the, yeah, governance, rule of law, and make sure that no one is above the law and it applies, yeah, to everyone.
I have a question for, when the women could vote also for election of the president in Mauritius. Was it at the same time as men, or was it?
You got me there. I can't remember exactly the date, but I knew that for a long time women had the vote. I can go and check, yeah, the exact date. I don't want to make a mistake here.
Okay.
But it was given, after in the 40s, 50s, because we were still under the era of the British colonial system, and there was a huge discrimination at the time as well, because the discrimination pointed to the fact that those who could vote were only those who could be who have education, and most of the people, their literacy was very low. So there was a lot of canvassing and a lot of people who actually went to the bedkas, the madrasas, and all these places, and galvanized people to go and get the vote. So I can send you the exact date where women got the vote, but I can tell you, whenever people don't go, I say to them, it was not a given. So please,
exactly,
go out
go
there,
to work.
Do,
yes,
your civic duty.
But with this, then the question about education and healthcare. So which role did public investment for, first of all, equity, play in the country's inclusive patterns of economic growth? And how can other developing countries maybe replicate this role if it was substantial?
Health has been free, as I mentioned, since independence. And so even now, there was an op-ed that was written by Joe Stiglitz when he visited us. Mm-hmm. And the opening phrases were, I visited this country that gave free education and free healthcare, and it is neither too rich and it's not on the verge of bankruptcy. And so he says, he was very surprised, but we even have, for example, cardiac surgery free of charge. So this is something that was given and is still being maintained. And I think that, all these are interlinked. When you provide these very basics, social safety net, healthcare, education, so people can then make choices because they know there is a buffer. They don't have to stay for one job, for example, because it's linked to a health insurance or a thing of that sort. People are much more willing to be entrepreneur when they feel that the state is providing something for them, yeah. So they can make choices.
Okay, my decision is made. After this interview, Svetlana, I'm heading for Mauritius.
No, I'm heading there, you know. I want some sun.
Especially with the weather and the land. I wanted to go to the next question then. The Republic of Mauritius has established itself as one of the main investment hubs in Africa, because I was reading the numbers. They're like amazing. You're hosting international banks, investment funds, private equities, despite of being such a tiny little country. So how does the Mauritius strong regulatory framework exclude investments that contribute to environmental deterioration and to climate crisis? I mean, looking at it more from the impact investment point of view and sustainable investment point of view.
Yeah. You know, there are many investments. Unfortunately, I've just listened to you just before the meeting started. You've talked about the pension fund, which mm-hmm. I invested so that, it doesn't open up. We don't have the Freedom of Information Act here that we can ask where the funds are being invested. But one area I know that has made a big difference, at least in drawing greener tourism, is the certification of some hotels. Mm-hmm. They have gone for the ISO 14,000 something. Right, the number, and they have shown that to be able to adhere to that certification, they need to recycle the water, they need to be greener in their approach, use less plastic, and so there is this general feel that in order to attract that level of clientele, you need to put yourself there and disclose what you're trying to do. And I know some of them, they are even going that extra mile of, you know, buying locally the fruit and vegetables so that they sustain the local economy as well. So these are measures which are being taken, at least from that sector. And also in terms of energy, we have an interesting mix of renewables, solar, bagasse, hydroelectric, and now we are hopefully, with us having this ambition to be an ocean state, wave energy will also be there very mm-hmm. soon, because that's also the technologies are there, a greener technology, cheap as well, so hopefully mm-hmm. we'll go that way as well.
Mm-hmm. That would be, I think, an ideal destination for impact investors. Once you
we start, definitely come, you cannot avoid us. We are coming to check that out.
But that would mean that your regulatory boards still do not have, for example, laws or regulations to promote sustainable-based impact investment?
No, this is it's already there. It's a brownie, but it's work in progress. And we're looking at the tendency, because we had made the pledges also in Paris to go greener in our energy production, greener, where of course using much more less polluting fuel. All the pledges have been taken. So all this is just work in progress. And I'm sure that the private sector, especially because the economy is driven mostly by the private sector, they see the benefits in there. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll be on the bandwagon very, very fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And another question. So does Mauritius promote also public investment in the environment? I mean, what was the evolution in this area over the last two decades? Do you really promote it, or how does it happening for investment?
No, we have to. We have no choice. As I said, we are now in a global village where whatever we do goes everywhere. It impacts, of course, our indicators that we have. So it's in our interest to really promote it. Energy-wise, we know that we'll have to go greener. We have to move up to 20 to at least 20, over 25% by 2025, get the mix, as I said, from, people are doing research now to get higher energy bagasse from the sugarcane, which is still there as a crop. As I said, all the renewable energies are being promoted. There are, of course, fiscal measures, of course, given to those who want to generate their own energy from solar panel. So all these are coming together so as to give a greener label. Of course, we have banned plastic as well as on this year. So plastic will not be used. So all these measures are being addressed. And we have a small island called Rodrigue, which is not very far, they had promoted sustainable fisheries for about over 5 years now. And so, you know, we are increasingly aware that we have to do something about it, not just talk about it and add to climate change, but do something. And the way to do that is to ensure that whatever we do is done in a sustainable manner.
Mm-hmm. Are there any, just out of curiosity, sorry, Ben, are there any electric cars like Tesla or any others driving on the, on your island at the moment? Do you have a network or...
Tesla, I think, is a bit out of reach. It's too expensive for the time being. But definitely, we are promoting. We had started looking at the mix of alcohol and fuel. And so that mix was coming. But I'm sure if the vehicle are reasonably priced, I'm sure they'll be here very soon. And the people will move very fast in that space.
Mm-hmm. And have you also made a commitment? For example, Finland has said they will become carbon neutral by 2035. EU has said they will become carbon neutral by 2050. Have you also made some kind of commitment like that?
I haven't heard in these very, very definite language. But we have accepted many of the pledges that were made in Paris in 2015. And so, you know, I'm sure very soon when they start the new budget, they'll be making all these, right now with COVID, everything is all upside down. But I think once they start getting their heads above water, they will be relooking at this, especially when it comes to budget time.
Mind you. Okay. That makes sense. And has gender equality in your country been impacted upon by growth and evolution in the agriculture sector?
Gender equality to me has been linked directly to education. And when people have started getting an education, women now, they are more aware of their rights, but of course, they're also aware of their responsibilities. We have seen many feminized sectors, like professionally in medicine, the judiciary, the police force, all these are strongly feminized. We're weak on the political side for many reasons, and I think it's true for many parts of the world. But things are moving in that direction. So there is awareness, and women now, they are more willing to take risks as well and become entrepreneur. So even in the agriculture sector, it's a sector which has been dominated for a long time by women, be it not at the level of management, but middle management, of course, lower down, they have been dominated by women.
And just moving deeper a little bit in agriculture sector, so I know that for example, multinational corporations are playing a big role in agricultural sector. And to what extent now does Mauritian agriculture rely on high yield hybrid seeds and chemical fertilizers, which are provided by these multinational corporations?
For a long time, our agriculture space, because we're still very small, so agriculture space has been dominated by sugarcane. And until the late 1990s, when we lost the protected market, this is when, of course, they started diversifying. But we are not really impacted by big corporation, and because the agriculture, fruit and vegetable, we produce just for internal consumption. We don't really export as much. But I know that this is a discussion which is happening on mainland Africa, where the issue of GM seeds, the issue of whether we should have a green revolution on the continent. There has been an attempt to have a green revolution. How do we actually reconcile intensive farming on the continent? Do we need to have a one-size-fits-all, as it's been happening elsewhere? I mean, these are discussions which are real, which are happening in Africa, not so much in Mauritius, because the space is far, far too small. Mm-hmm. And just for a long time, it was dominated by King Sugar. But that discussion is happening on the continent, and especially as the continent had experienced, at least some countries, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. And I think 10 years later, there has been evaluation. But I think increasingly, it's pointing to the obvious that there is a no one size fits all when it comes to this space of agriculture.
Here in Europe and also all around the world, the sugar consumption actually decreased. And in Australia, they're facing, for example, even the farmers are facing problems to sell the sugar, and they're looking for alternative crops. How is it in Mauritius? Are the farmers also switching or trying to find other alternative crops, or is it still okay for them with sugar supply?
Yeah, you know, we produce about 400,000 tons of sugar, exported mostly to the European Union. And when we lost the market, because we were given a preferential price with the EU being having been a past colony, it is still there. It is still produced. But we, you know, it doesn't worry us so much, because now sugar is a byproduct of the cane industry. Because for the cane industry, it's the bagasse, the fiber, which is much more valuable because it's used to generate energy. So it is going to the IPP, the independent power producers. And so sugar itself is a byproduct. But there is something which is interesting coming out of the byproduct of sugar cane, of sugar, is the molasses. And with that molasses, there's so much that can be done. But what we have done in Mauritius is go to one step higher. We innovate in the sugar. We have started producing special sugars, like, you know, high-quality demerara and all these sugars, which we now export, producing niche product for niche markets overseas.
Now that there are so many vegans around the world, how do you stand with vegan, vegetarian on your island? Because you have amazing animals. So I hope people are also keeping the animals for watching and not for eating. How is it there?
No, I mean, people, you know, many of our folks here, they are vegetarian. And in some instances, it's a religious thing. But you know, there's complete freedom of whomsoever, you know, whatever dietary measures they want to adopt. So there is no problem with veganism or being vegetarian or being animal eaters as well. So there's no problem.
I mean, being vegan at most is much easier than somewhere in Siberia or
Switzerland. Have a variety here.
With your amazing fruits and vegetables. Are they organically produced? Your fruits.
Yes, that's a movement which is coming up. So people are increasingly, they are adopting agroecological, methods. And this is something that we encourage. And this is, again, something which is being looked at very, very carefully on the African continent, how to go back to agroecology, how to protect the soil, how to use indigenous knowledge. And this is something I spent all my life working on documenting, because I feel that intensive agriculture, as we have seen it happen in countries that have experienced the Green Revolution, as I said, may not be adapted at all for the continent. We need to go back, relook at traditional approaches, traditional knowledge, and look at indigenous crops as well, because experiments have shown that those farmers that bring in indigenous trees, they get higher yields for the crops they're growing. So this is, again, something that we certainly need to move away from monocrop agriculture. We have seen the disaster that this has brought, especially when forests are cut down to promote monocrop agriculture. So this is an education that has to be brought in with support from other organizations. But more importantly, look at agriculture as a means for ensuring food security on the continent. But agriculture, to me, in Africa, has to play a much more significant role, because 60% of the world's arable land in Africa, in the world, is in Africa. And Africa at the moment has been evaluated to be a $1 trillion business. And it's a sector which, if we do it properly, we can provide jobs for these young people coming out of Africa. And the World Bank figures are telling us that it is 12 million graduates per year reaching the job market every year. So we need to do something about it. And I think agriculture has a very key role to play in promoting job creation for these young people through innovative practices. And innovative practices need not necessarily exclude traditional practices which have been there, which have worked, which have given results.
Well, then, just on the field of agriculture, because an old friend of mine, Kofi Annan. He's created one of this organization, or he was in the AGRA, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. And it's a partnership-driven institution set with the goal of transforming the small farmers, small-holding farmers in Africa, from a solitary struggle to survive in the business. To what extent do you resonate with the AGRA's mission, particularly with respect to small-holder farmers' entrance in the global market? Because that brings a lot of consequences with it.
I think when late Kofi Annan started that, in fact, the very word, the acronym, is an alliance for green revolution in Africa.
Yeah.
So it was felt then almost 12 years ago when that started, I think over 12 years ago, that they needed to tackle agriculture as a sector for promoting food security, as I said, for promoting jobs, especially to look at the needs of the small farmers, because agriculture is driven mostly by, in the informal sector, by smallholder farmers, and also women, because women feed the continent, and women feed many countries in the world, but in Africa it rings true for this. So the idea was precisely to look at the farmer, but unfortunately 10 years when they have started evaluating the impact, it has shown that it has not given what they had thought it would be given in terms of yield, in terms of cash to the farmers. And again, this is something that we really need to look at. Did we adopt the approach of a one-size-fits-all again in terms of using other practices elsewhere and putting it locally? And also one thing we have to caveat up front is that over 80% of agricultural practice in Africa is still rain-fed. And we're operating in a changing climate. So have these factors been taken on board when we look at agriculture as a sector? And this we have seen many, many crops failures in Zimbabwe, in so many other countries, where crops have failed because of a changing weather pattern and climate and rain pattern. So I think people who are evaluating AGRA at the moment, I think they've been confronted with this reality that they need to go back to the drawing board, look at the needs of the small farmers, because those who are operating have huge areas. They will always stand to gain, be it they bring in the hybrids, they bring in all the seeds they want, they will be winners. But I think we have to look at those farmers who are operating on small plots and who have a family to feed and who have to ensure food security and all that goes with it. So this is where I think where maybe the results are not that promising. Mm-hmm.
Today we are talking at the same time a lot. Yeah. Now it ladies today. Now you allow me, Ben? Can I?
Yeah, just go ahead. So I don't dare to say anything. I'll just keep my mouth shut.
No, because Amina always provides such insightful input that right away we want to ask even more. So the question would be, because you mentioned that hybrid seeds, right? And actually farmers have to buy them every year because they only can use it once. And then the consequence is that their stocks decrease over time and they have no possibility to go back to the traditional way of farming. So what would be the solution for these issues and that their biodiversity is prevailed?
Yep. I think the issue confronting farmers on the continent, as I said, is water, access to water. And this is not something that has been really been addressed in many of the models that have been laid down. We have talked a lot about seed production, and there has been a move at some point to help bring seeds out onto the continent. But one thing, as a scientist, I have some concern here, because when you look at hybrid seeds, which are brought in, they will ensure one crop, one harvest, maybe two harvests. But what happens to the diversity of the crops which are there, What happens to the plants which have been there for long, that have resisted the changes, the climate change which is happening? And I feel that, you know, this is where the indigenous crops that we have should be looked at. The seeds have to be protected, and this is where we need to start developing seed banks and mm-hmm. access of these farmers to these original seeds. And unfortunately, it has become a big business by some big corporation. And we need to look at very, very carefully. Why we need to look that very carefully? Because this diversity, as I said up front earlier in the conversation, is only found in the tropics. Unfortunately, our food, the way we feed ourselves, we rely on about 20 crops, right? And there is such a diversity in Africa. Now, if I go back to one country, which was of India in the 1980s, when the Green Revolution was just starting there in Punjab, they had identified over 50,000 rice species, right? And by the time they have gone through, and now if you look at the way rice has been planted in that part of the world, they're relying on just about 40 species or 40 varieties of rice. So what happened to the rest? Now, the problem is not just so much the harvest, because I'm sure they're getting good harvest from these 40 species. I'm thinking within a changing climate, assuming you get the agriculture COVID, it wipes off all the species, what happens then? So that's why I had joined movements in the past to start saving the seeds, to start mm-hmm. saving the indigenous plants, to start saving mm-hmm. seeds all over the place to do that. I'm sorry about that.
You have a cool cat. Biodiversity in animals.
So this is what we need to do, is to protect the seeds locally and also to protect the seeds regionally, because there has to be exchanges in the various in the climatic conditions where these plants are growing. Now, I'll tell you a small story, is that there was at some point a very bad rust infection in Canada, in wheat. And they were looking for that gene that could save the plantation. And you know where they found it? They found it out in Turkey, because they were doing the same kind of work, and they were actually, you know, collecting the species and doing all this. So this is why we need to safeguard this germplasm, because we don't know what tomorrow is made of. In fact, I just come up with another example. We look at corn. Corn is a crop which has been growing in Central America. Of course, a staple in Mexico. But over 70% of the germplasm of corn has been contaminated by GMOs. So what mm-hmm. happens tomorrow if there is a COVID for corn? Mm-hmm. Where are we going to get these species which are going to be resilient enough to cope with these changes? So this is where, to me, the issue lies, is how to protect the seeds, how to protect the germplasm, how mm-hmm. to ensure that there is resilience of these seeds. You know, increasingly, we're looking at also something which is very dear to these people. We're looking at seed sovereignty. We're looking at food sovereignty. We're looking at health sovereignty. So all these are all interconnected. What we eat and what we grow, all these have to be brought back to in the hands of the farmers. And we need to listen to them. We need to listen to these women who are custodian of traditional knowledge. Mm-hmm. And you need to use traditional knowledge to create that third way between tradition and hard science. Because if you look at the Aborigines, if you look at the way they survive, they will give you many ideas of how these traditional ways of looking at things, traditional ways of doing business, will ensure our survival. So we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to start listening to these people again.
So yep. How can impact investing help those women? Is it a problem of money here as well or not? Can investors contribute to this issue?
We need impact investment because it will address, for example, if we have impact investment in food security, we will be looking at all these issues that we have just been talking about. We'll be looking at creating the infrastructure, for example, for safeguarding seeds. And of course, the returns will not be there on investment straight away. And this is what impact investment is all about. But we need to be looking at all these measures because, as I said, we are addressing the common good. And the common good will not be resolved by a quick return on investment on the first 2 years of investing. So this is where we need that impact investment. We need the philanthropists. And this is, again, for Africa, I keep soliciting the African philanthropist. I said, look, this is our continent. Let us do that. But science being, of course, a collaborative affair, we'll need the support of all scientists because it's a process of collaboration. We need all of us working together, and agriculture is a fantastic theme to bring people together. We are addressing food security. We are addressing the needs of the people. So, you know, it's a fantastic place to bring people together.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was reading, that food and water is going to be the new gold or the new oil.
Yes, food, water, and if you look at one more, again, data is now the new oil. And we know what is happening now with our data. So yeah. We need to be moving.
We know or we don't know. That's the scary part.
Yes. What's the name of the cat? Maybe we can call her from time to time, then she will know.
It's called Milo.
Milo. Milo knows that I'm a fan of cats. So.
Yes, I'm a fool.
Wow. It's one more reason to come to visit you in Mauritius.
Yes.
Yes.
Because I was just thinking, yes. I remember the old times in India. I think this was in 80s or 90s. I'm not certain anymore. There were a lot of suicide among the farmers.
Yes.
Because
yes.
they were using modified seeds, which were infertile. So the farmers, normally what they used to do is they used to keep a part of their harvest for the next year's crop,
yes,
and
yes,
which they could not do anymore because these were infertile seeds, which made them completely dependent on these MNCs to buy their seeds, which they couldn't afford. So they went further and further into debt.
Exactly.
Did you also face the same?
They all linked, and this is again something that we need to be addressing in our discussion, because we tend to isolate, you know, the farmer's suicide, and unfortunately, we saw what happened in India over the past few days in terms of the deregulating, liberalizing all these agriculture sector. And there are reforms to be made. There is no doubt about this, but I think the fundamental issue is that we need to be looking at all, you know, look at the holistic approach of what needs to be done. And definitely seeds will remain central. Access to water for agriculture for Africa remains central. And but of course the regulations have to be there so that it works for everybody. But definitely reforms need to be done. But again, it all depends how we tackle it. So that is the essence of the whole thing.
Amina, but we are very action-oriented, you know, and the purpose of the show is to move people, to move capital. So is there already a Mauritius Impact Investing Agri-Fund which could support? Because I know many investors are going to Mauritius and they probably would be more than happy to invest in something, even if it's long-term. Right? So is there already structure there out?
You know, the structure, you know, if we have a very agile way of looking at this, and this to us, to the policymakers up front, it will be considered as FDI. There's no doubt about this. But this is something which is very close to my heart. And in fact, I had been working with, giving my voice when I was president for the, you know, to gather funds to make seed banks and, of course, germplasm collection. And I don't know whether you know about this, Ben. It's the Crop Trust, and I was involved with that. And of course, some of the seeds were stored in the Svalbard in Norway. And my vision rather was increase the seed banks locally, and of course have a repository in the region. And then have a third one in the Svalbard for the future. And so this is something which is very close to my heart, and I would like really to see that, not just for the seed sector, but for general biodiversity, which touched on food, because we have, unfortunately, many what we call neglected species, underutilized species, and these underutilized species and neglected species, they are the solution for hidden hunger. And so this is something that we need to tackle. And if you look at nutrition problem, they are very often related to hidden hunger because the nutrients are not there. So this is something that I would like to really go into. And the other one, which unfortunately doesn't get a lot of traction, is fungi. There is a lot of edible fungi, but unfortunately, not enough work has been done in terms of identification, in terms of classification. And again, these are things that we need to do. And also, one thing which people don't talk about enough is that the prime mover of agriculture, as we know, the protection of our soil, rests with fungi. And people don't talk about this. So these are issues which matter if we are to further agriculture holistically, is to look at all these sectors which touch from far and from, of course, closer, this sector, which is agriculture.
Next time I have a discussion with you, I'll have my book and pen and paper with me. I'm learning so much. I didn't know about anything about the fungi being such an essential part for agriculture.
Yeah, it is very, very important. Of course, we talk about agriculture, we talk about biodiversity conservation, we talk about soil conservation. As I said, we look generally at agroecology, and there's so much. It's a very, very rich and powerful theme that we have to be addressing to ensure food security in the long term. Sustainability.
I'm so glad this conversation is being taped. I have to go through the recording again. I just wanted to ask another question. That is, so we have this decreasing, which I just mentioned, the farmers have this seeds. So we have the decreasing stock of farm seeds, which is making the farmers more and more dependent on the products of MNCs. That is like the hybrid seeds and things like that. But this is also what I just mentioned in India happened, is that a lot of farmers became heavily indebted. But on the other hand, linkage to the global market as an income generating is thought out to be a very good source of income for the farmers, and which also Agra is promoting for. It's supposed to avoid that. However, the question is, by promoting export-oriented cash crops, whose prices on the international market are extremely volatile, I mean, you must have noticed, especially with the COVID situation at this moment, so isn't Agra going to increase the farmers' vulnerability to the international market? Because then they are more and more dependent on the pricing of the international market, which, you know, from today to tomorrow, it can change drastically. And when the shock happens, then this time, it not only impacts the businesses and the financial sectors, it also impacts the farmers, who are anyway very vulnerable and very weak. So how is it possible to interrupt the indebtedness cycle of the small farmers, like in India, where most of the farmers on average are smallholders, considering what the hybrid seed of the MNCs are doing to them?
Ben, I think we'll need another conversation on this, because it is such an important subject. And we have seen, I'll just look at one crop. Let's look at cotton, right? Mm-hmm. Cotton was being grown very well in India when it was mixed with other crops, and they were doing it, of course, in a subsistence manner. There was no problem. And then somebody got the bright idea of bringing in GM cotton, and then we saw what happened on that. And then if you step back and come to Africa, cotton is also a very, very important crop in West Africa. But they cannot compete with the big players because of the subsidy issue. Right? So this is, again, where we'll need to have institutions operating. We need to have, those like, for example, the WTO, we need to have it back in action again. And so this calls for a global view of agriculture. But as I said, again, we cannot neglect the fact that a lot of these traditional ways of doing things had worked for so long for all these small farmers. So we need to relook at many of these crops. Cash crop has its place, and unfortunately has given us mountains of wheat, mountains of all these kind of thing. But we need to go back to the drawing board of seeing, like in many countries where the agriculture is driven by small farmers, women who are producing food, not just commodities. So all these discussions have to be looked at, but it has to be looked at holistically. And otherwise, we will still be talking about Agra 2 10 years down the line of not delivering as we would have thought. So it's a discussion which needs to be had.
But you just mentioned cotton and WTO, which is very good, because cotton, the issue with the cotton is that I don't think WTO can do much about it, because the Chinese have subsidized it so heavily and so seriously that it has impacted cotton production all over the world. And WTO has not been very effective to do anything about it. So how? So even if we go back to the situation previously, like you mentioned, coming back to the multilateral system, I have big question marks how effective it would be, or maybe we need another discussion on that.
No, we've had some example that had helped African countries, at least Mauritius textile industry had been had benefit from that. Is the American AGOA, Africa Growth Opportunity Act, which of course touches on where we benefited because we don't grow cotton, but we benefit what we call the third country fabric. We can import from African countries, for example. So we need to relook at the sectors initially that can help these farmers whose livelihoods depend on cotton. And we know the quality of the cotton comes out of West Africa, good quality cotton. We also know that some of the good cotton come out of Egypt. And of course, we know that, well, if you look at, I'm just focusing on my continent, but I know that India has been, of course, a very big player. You mentioned China. So I think this is where we need to look at this solidarity. And for us, AGOA has been highly, highly beneficial to really help the textile sector move ahead. So what will the new administration do in terms of addressing all these? So this again needs to be done because we don't want dumping. We don't want, all these discussions we've been having, but we need to find ways that will help the farmers. And I think Africa now is at the cusp of something big because we have just signed up to the free trade agreement. We are now creating a local market, an internal market of 1.2 billion. While the rest we are seeing Brexit happening in Europe, we have decided to go to look inside. Now, this is going to be a big boost because first of all, hopefully we will save a lot on foreign exchange, because there's no reason why Ghana cannot trade with Kenya on cotton, or Burkina Faso cannot sell its cotton and have the catwalk in South Africa. I mean, these are things that we really need to look at very carefully, because if we can tap in that local market, local African market, I think already we will be making very big strides.
What about partnerships with nonprofit organizations or more broadly sustainable investing? Are there any partnerships happening maybe with European or US organizations right now? Or would you look at that if it's not yet happening?
From where we are, we can't not look at partnership. Come on, this is very, very vital. We need a partnership. In fact, we have signed up quite a few trade agreements with many countries. We have signed up with China. It operationalized on the 1st of January. We have a very interesting partnership with India. We've had, of course, Africa, we have signed up to the free trade agreement. We had been members of BLOC, like Southern African Development Community, the Eastern African Community, COMESA. So we have been working along these blocks for a long, long time. So definitely we need partnership. Yeah. And through partnership, we can see how we can do, many, many things together, definitely. So partnership is there. And as I said, one of the biggest partnership has been with AGOA. And of course, there's many items there. We have focused on textile, but by, I think, 2024 is going to be relooked by Congress. So we hope that this will continue so that this affirmative action is done for African continent, African countries, that we can, of course, export and, diversify the market as well.
Mm-hmm. I think we talked a lot about seeds, but now let's maybe talk more about women empowerment, because I'm really curious how this happening in Mauritius and Africa. I mean, precisely Mauritius, because it's more about this little island. Share with us some stories of women empowerment.
As I said, women have been empowered from the day that they have been able to go to school and get an education. So we have seen a lot of feminization of many sectors. As I said, judiciary, the medical profession, and now we see many entrepreneurs who are coming out who are women. So they are getting to grasp with what they can do as a community of women. But one thing I must point out, Svetlana, is that women, they are not very good at supporting women. And this is a shortcoming.
Why not?
And my narrative, and I always cite Madeleine Albright there, is that there is a special place in hell for those women who do not help women.
you know Madeleine Albright.
Yeah, well, I didn't meet her, but I've read her books and I cite her saying all the time. In fact, earlier on this week, I had a meeting with Sirleaf Johnson's Foundation, and we're talking about ways of empowering women through solidarity for women, all right? So we need to develop this culture of supporting women. And when a woman has got there, we have to make sure, as a community of women, to ensure that she stays there for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with this statement. You know, I also faced in my career some women which were not very supportive, but luckily they are much more supportive ones on the way. So I don't want to be in this little place in the hell. So any women on my way, I generously support anything I can.
Yes.
I'll just add something and then shut up on this, is that I grew up in India. I mean, I'm born in India. And there's this famous story of the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. That's always the same.
It's perennial.
Yeah.
I think it's in any country, no?
Yes, it's everywhere. It's competition for the sun's attention.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, but Ben, you are from, I presume, from Bengal, with a name like Banerjee?
My ancestors, but we are three generations. In Lucknow.
Yes. So, because there is a matriarchy, if I may say so.
Yeah. So now you understand why every time Svetlana speaks, I immediately shut up.
Of course.
Okay, I will use this opportunity to ask another question then.
Yes.
About sea levels, you know, do you really feel it in Mauritius, like the sea levels are rising and... is it visible, or how do you experience that, actually, so climate change?
Yeah, with the symptom, of course, is erosion, mm-hmm. and erosion of the beach. And in some places, we have seen a lot of beaches which are being eroded. Mm-hmm. So this is, to us, it's symptomatic that there is a rise in the sea level. It's been monitored, but as I say, again, it's not something that we can do at our level alone. What we can do is adapt to that, make sure that, for example, the water doesn't seep into the freshwater aquifers. We have to look at ways of, you know, where there's brackish water, how we can grow in that brackish water. And I know there's some research going on in Chennai when I visited Professor Swaminathan Institution, how they are making the best of brackish water growing halophyte. Of course, the results, you know, will take time to get to a level where it will help resolve food crisis. But I think recognition of that is there already. So we need to join with that, with the way things are moving, and adapt to that way of doing business, and research, and look at ways where we can grow food crops. You know, you name it, and learn to adapt. But definitely, the sea is rising. The cyclones are getting more violent. We have seen that in some parts of the Seychelles, even in Mauritius, we have seen coral bleaching. Even the Great Barrier Reef has been bleached as well. So these are, to me, direct impact of rising temperatures. And of course, you know, the sea cannot absorb all the carbon dioxide. And if you expect the sea to absorb all the carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. acidification of the water will be there. Mm-hmm. And acidification means what it means in terms of the imbalance in the marine life. And we have seen the water temperature, the rising, is already affecting the humpback whales from procreating. So, you know, all the imbalance are there. So it's in our interest to see to it that whatever we do, we work with nature. We don't work against nature because we stand to lose.
Yeah. Going a little bit towards a disastrous scenario, like, is there any projection if we continue the same way, for how many years Mauritius can be there and it's still possible to live there and see the corals, the biodiversity? So how bad are the forecasts if we continue the same way? we don't change.
Well, if we look at the report from the IPCC, the climate change, we were at risk, but we have put in measures which we can adapt. We are not that low. If you look at Maldives, for example, they're very, very low, 3 meters above sea. So we're not there yet. So I think if we are going to look at the whole situation positively, hopefully, if we adapt, if we take the measures at the international level, we should be able to overcome this, because nature regenerates very fast, but we have to give her a chance. And if we give her a chance, we will survive, because this is our livelihoods that we are safeguarding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I suggest you take some questions from the audience now.
Please. Yes, sure.
Yeah, let's give opportunity to our female and not female audience to ask questions. I take the first one. Dear Professor Amina Gourifakhim, thank you for your interview. Do you think that we hold the right tools to change climate change? How do we transform the current awareness into action?
Well, this is the thing. So far, we have been talking a lot. We have been making pledges. And these pledges have changed by virtue of who leads the multilateral level. But definitely, we will need to move fast. As I said, creating the Green Fund for adaptation, we need to capitalize the Green Fund faster, because there have been pledges, but not enough in terms of delivery. And we really need to change the way we exploit fossil fuel. Renewable energy is there. It is becoming cheaper. The technology is being accessible. So we need to help those countries transition to renewable energy. So again, it requires partnership, because the greenhouse gas remain the biggest polluter. We need to green our way of doing things. We need to ban plastic. And this requires, of course, serious decision at decision-making level of the government. They need to do that. And so all these are measures we can do. And we can do our own little bit, but it can remain at that level. But we need bigger, bolder decision at international level that will percolate down to countries so that we can really address this. Because, again, as I said, we are not saving nature. Nature doesn't need us. We need nature. We have to ensure that we realize that we are interconnected, and we need to stop cutting the forest. And because cutting forest to grow one single crop is a disaster, we need the diversity of the forest, we need the diversity of the species. We have to rewild nature, and this we can do at individual level. We have to stop cutting trees. We have to rewild nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lot of comments also from the audience about reforestation, that it's really important for climate change. Ben, do you have any other question from
there? I was just going to jump back to my favorite, that's the MNCs. So in 2017, Monsanto executive, they drafted the policy on seed uses for Malawi, for the Ministry of Agriculture, which is also a partner country of AGRA. The policy reclassified farm-saved seeds as grain. So that means, in other words, commercially unsaleable, effectively leaving the farmers and seed producers who did not have such kind of existing partnership with MNCs out of the commercial line. Should partnership with non-profit and more broadly sustainable investment targeted towards smallholder farmer instead of focusing or promoting indigenous farm saved seed varieties, and also through support of sale and exchange?
I think what's happening in Malawi is, as I mentioned earlier on, the Indian example of the rice is a bis repetita, right? They have such a wide variety of different crops, different seeds, and if you start imposing that, what we're going to do, we're going to mess up the agriculture space completely. And as I said, the 50,000 species of rice which were grown in India whittled down to 40. And we know what that means in terms of ensuring food security in the changing climate. So we really need to look at the way of doing things. I mean, I'm not against GM. I'm not against all these. But what we have to do is be very pragmatic in the way we do things. If you look at fortified food has been an excellent tool in resolving hunger, hidden hunger. right? But there is no reason why we don't have to really look at the unneglected and underutilized plant species, which can also provide solutions for hidden hunger. So it has to be a mix of things, but definitely seed production must be left in the hands of those farmers, and the way they have been doing it for a long, long time has to be maintained. And the way we actually classify commodities as seeds, or you know, whatever we call it, has to be re-looked at, because it is not going to be sustainable in the long run.
Exactly. Oh, then I'll jump to one question from the audience. How do you convince the traditional business into a sustainable one in your country?
Again, it's what are the finale of whatever the business is doing. As I've said, if we look at the hotel industry, for example, it has been a business which has been there for a long, long time in our country. We know that it's a business model that really needs to be re-looked at, because so far we have been selling a dream, we have been selling the sea, we have been selling the sun, we have been selling the sand. This is a model which has worked. It will work to some extent with some people. But if we want to actually relaunch this business, especially now as we're moving into the post-COVID era, we have to look at a model that is going to be attractive, that we add value. So it can become sustainable if we add in the other ingredients. For me, it's culture. For me, it's the diversity of our people. We are a population that has come from everywhere. So we have something to offer, because we have blended into each other's cultures. We have seen Mauritian cuisine, for example, morphing from what was traditionally Indian to something what I call Creole. So this is something that we can sell. So one industry, one business model that has been traditional in selling one particular image of Mauritius can morph into something which is much more sustainable, because then we'll be saying that, for example, we are a country that recycle everything, where circular economy matters. So these are models that we have to reinvent and we have to relook at, and it's easily doable. But there has to be the political will and also the will of ensuring sustainable practices in the future.
And how is this political will? Because Switzerland is also a little country, you know, and is direct democracy, and people really can influence political decisions and generate initiatives, which can be, I mean, it's not done from one day to another, but it can be put through, you know, in political system, and then new laws are there. How is it in Mauritius? Where is the political system standing in terms of sustainability? Are they very supportive or not?
You know, I'll tell you something I didn't think I would say until I occupy that space for a little while. We give too much importance to politicians. The people don't realize their strength. I think now, with the power of social media, they are realizing how much they can influence. And this goes in. So I say to young people, start voting with your social media account. Start voting with your wallet. Start voting with your conviction, because you have the power, not the politicians. They will go where the mood is. They will go with a swing, but ask for accountability. That's what you have to do.
Absolutely agree. Also, financial sector is the same. You know, once the clients with money ask for sustainable funds, impact investing, then some banks create products for this need. So it's absolutely correct.
I'll have to ask the technical team to cut out this part, because a lot of my political friends are watching this.
But they realize that now. They do realize the power of the people. And the people can make a lot of changes. And I think there is a movement across the world now to address the issue of sustainability, because COVID, whatever it has done, decimated economies, it has brought one important feature out: the interconnectedness of this species, the human species, with the rest of its environment.
I think this is a word of this edition, interconnectedness. I really like it. Because as also a yogi, I truly believe that we are all connected.
In case, Amina, you didn't know, she's also a yoga teacher.
Okay. I do that as well.
Try not to be too spiritual during our TV show. But sometimes a consciousness shift is important to take in action.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yes.
Oh, the time completely ran out. I just wanted to finish with one last question from the audience. What do you think about blue economy?
You know, blue economy for us, it's going to be our survival into the future, right? We are surrounded by the sea. But, you know, there's something that people have to understand is that over 70% of the ocean space is outside countries' jurisdiction. And this is where we really need to tackle this because, you know, it's the far west out there. Yep. And if we look at the blue economy as a generator of, as sustaining economies, we have to look at the fauna, we have to look at the flora, we have to look at everything else. It's all there. But again, we need to find an institution or institutions that can address those waters which are beyond jurisdiction. And this is where a lot of damage is happening because there is no jurisdiction there. And the pollution is there. And this is where we need to safeguard humanity's future by looking at ways of ensuring clean oceans. So it's there.
I fully agree with you. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
For your time and on behalf of the viewers. It was really amazing. Next time I'll have my notebook with me.
Thank you, Amina. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And hope to see you in Switzerland or maybe in Mauritius.
Of course, yes, we should do.
You're invited to our country to smell some snow or ski.
Yes, I love the snow. I miss, in fact, I would have been in Davos otherwise. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Amina. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to inform about the next week. So our next week guest would be Martin Palmer, the chairman of the Faith Invest, which is created more than a year back. It's the investment of the 12 major religious communities in the world. And it's a massive amount. And they are investing in social and environmental projects worldwide. So that will be next Friday. So see you next Friday then. Bye-bye.
See you, everyone.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.